modern jazz on a grander scale. Instead, they settled for a pretty, hollow refinement, diluting the impact of an artist who was at his best when no strings were attached. This onstage propriety was increasingly at odds with the travails of Parker's private life. Drug addiction had taken its toll. Rolling up his sleeve and showing the needle marks on his arm, Parker told a friend, "This is my home. This is my portfolio. This is my Cadillac." Byrd was barely 30, yet he looked much older. His once taut figure now took on a bloated aspect, and he tipped the scales at over 200 pounds. He was bothered by an ulcer, and his doctor warned of a possible heart condition. His relationship with Doris Seidner, who had traveled to California to be lady-in-waiting during his Camarillo internment, was now breaking up, and Parker was renewing his ties with Chan Richardson. Au courant with the ways of jazz musicians and artists, Chan could be a soulmate in a way that Doris was not. But there was a trade-off. Doris, with a doting, almost maternal attitude toward Parker, had shielded him, as best she could, from the seamier side of the jazz milieu. She would wait for him at clubs, carry his saxophone, try to pick up the pieces of his dissipated life. With Chan, Parker made only fleeting attempts to settle down. Such stability ultimately proved too confining. When his daughter Pri died, Parker was on the road, lodging with sculptress Julie McDonald. Chan had been forced to take Pri to public clinics, because there was no money for a private doctor. This at a time when Parker was at the peak of his fame and earning potential. But even when he wasn't out of town, Parker had little attachment for hearth and home. When he succumbed to his own final illness, Byrd was back in New York. But even then, he opted to recuperate at the apartment of a lady friend, rather than stay with Chan and his son. The instability could be seen in Parker's onstage life. True, at any given performance, he was still capable of extraordinary music making. His 1953 Toronto concert at Massey Hall, alongside Gillespie, Mingus, Roach, and Powell, has been marketed as the greatest jazz concert ever, and for once the exaggerated hype of the record company is somewhat justified by the level of the music. Other late performances, in 1952 at Rockland Palace, in 1953 with the orchestra in Washington, D.C., show that Parker, at his best, still had to be considered the preeminent saxophonist in modern jazz, despite his private turmoils. But these moments of glory were far from the norm in Parker's final years. The regular working band of the 1940s had by now given way to less permanent settings. He would play with pickup groups in different cities, or tour with Stan Kenton or Jazz at the Philharmonic. At other times, he brought a string orchestra on the road, playing the same warmed-over arrangements night after night, set after set. His behavior on stage could be erratic or rude, and at times he might not show at all, causing club owners to grow wary. One night he fired the entire string orchestra during a performance, then left the empty stage to drink whiskey at the bar. Matters were further complicated by Parker's problems with his cabaret card, which made it difficult for him to work in New York during a period of almost 2 years. There was heavy symbolism in the fact that Parker even came to be considered persona non grata at Birdland, the premier jazz club that had been named in the altoist's honor in 1950. His final club appearance was marred by an embarrassing onstage confrontation with pianist Bud Powell, an unfortunate swan song to cap Byrd's volatile career. His health, both physical and mental, had been precarious for some time. So many rumors circulated, most of them plausible if not true. He had swallowed iodine in an apparent suicide attempt. He had been twice hospitalized at Bellevue, where he made ominous comments about his own impending demise. Friends would tell of Byrd arriving unannounced, knocking at doors in the middle of the night, seeking drugs, money, distraction. The inevitable terminal illness came in March 1955. Parker needed to get to Boston for a club engagement, but, beset by the pain of his aggravated ulcer, made it no farther than the apartment of his friend, the Baroness Panonica de Königswarter. A doctor was called in, but Parker refused to go to a hospital. 3 days later, he finally succumbed. His death was attributed to the combined effects of a bleeding ulcer and pneumonia. But these were only the arbitrary final causes. Even more telling was the other notation on the death certificate, the doctor's estimate of Parker's age. Not knowing the true dates, he guessed that his patient was between 50 and 60 years old. In fact, Parker was only 34. Most of the soloists at Birdland had to wait for Parker's next record in order to find out what to play next. "What will they do now?" Charles Mingus queried. There was a touch of exaggeration in Mingus's claim, but only a touch. During his lifetime, Parker exerted a hypnotic influence on the younger generation of jazz musicians, and his mystique not only continued unabated after his death, but even intensified. His life now took on the quality of legend. "Bird is not dead," Mingus continued. "He's hiding out somewhere, and he'll be back with some new shit that will scare everyone to death." Picking up on this theme, Parker devotees brandished the phrase, "Bird lives," anticipating with their in-denial obsession the postmortem Elvis fascination of a later generation, employing the slogan as a talisman, motto, and enigmatic graffiti all rolled into one. But when Parker, unlike the King, failed to be spotted at supermarkets, if only on the cover of a checkout counter tabloid, most bop fans turned their energy toward finding the next Bird, the new hot alto saxophonist who would carry the jazz idiom to another level. Only 3 months after Parker's death, Julian Cannonball Adderley arrived in New York. Within days of sitting in with a band at Cafe Bohemia, he was the talk of the town. True to form, Adderley's record company promoted him as the new Bird. And though Cannonball's assured technique and flair for improvisation may have reminded many of his famous predecessor, his warmer tone was a marked departure from the Parker model, as was his more rhythmically rooted approach to phrasing. Adderley served a brief but memorable stint with Miles Davis, during which he participated on the seminal Kind of Blue session, and in time developed a more controlled style of improvisation, with greater sensitivity to space and a more relaxed delivery. If Adderley failed to become the bebop messiah that fans were seeking, he nonetheless did an admirable job of pleasing both jazz purists and casual audiences, who relished his funk-inflected performances such as Dis Here, Work Song, and Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. Phil Woods, another much-lauded disciple of Bird, also made a splash on the New York jazz scene in the mid-1950s, both through his work as a leader and in his extensive sideman efforts. His professionalism, technical facility, and smooth attack enabled Woods to fit in with ease in almost any musical setting, whether the commercial pop music of a Billy Joel, who featured Woods on the hit song Just the Way You Are, or the much different soundscapes of Benny Goodman or Thelonious Monk. For a time, Woods was perhaps too much in demand as a session player. His gigs as a bandleader became less frequent, and his promise as a major jazz star seemed destined to be only partly realized. Between 1958 and 1967, Woods made only 4 recordings as a leader. But with the formation of his excellent European ensemble in 1968, and his return to bebop roots with his post-1974 American bands, Woods made it clear that he belongs on any short list of leading post-Parker alto saxophonists. Jackie McLean, a third altoist to come of age in the shadow of Parker during the 1950s, took a different approach to the instrument. While others emulated Parker's virtuosity and borrowed verbatim various licks and 2-5-1 cadences, McLean offered a sparser, more jagged approach. It was the spirit of Bird, his intensity, his drive, his raw emotion, not, as with so many other saxophonists, mimicked phrases and patterns that came through in McLean's music. Unlike Adderley and Woods, he adopted an acerbic tone, one distinctly unsuitable for pop music or pseudo-funk hits. His early work with Miles Davis, and as a leader, revealed an allegiance to the bop style, but McLean remained open to the influence of other approaches, with elements of John Coltrane's modal excursions, Sonny Rollins's hard bop, and Ornette Coleman's free playing eventually entering into his music. By the time of his vital recordings from the 1960s for the Blue Note label, McLean was brandishing an urgent sax style, one that had largely discarded the formulaic resolutions of bop. These 3 players, Adderley, Woods, McLean, in turn came to be revered as influential stylists in their own right, with a host of younger players following in their footsteps. We can trace this influence, for example, in the 1980s work, respectively, of Richie Cole, Vincent Herring, and Bobby Watson. But behind all these figures, the larger influence of Charlie Parker could still be felt, almost as strongly as during his lifetime. Bird's impact extended to the West, Art Pepper, Sonny Criss, Bud Shank, and the East, Charles Mariano, Ernie Henry, Dave Schildkraut, to the baritone, Leo Parker, Serge Chaloff, Cecil Payne, and the tenor, Teddy Edwards, Dexter Gordon, Sonny Rollins. Indeed, almost everywhere one looked on the jazz landscape. For better or worse, the bebop vocabulary refined by Parker and his contemporaries remained either an explicit source of inspiration or, at a minimum, a reference point for virtually all post-bop jazz styles during the next half century. Even the avant-garde musicians who, on the surface, seemed to rebel the most vociferously against the dominance of bop were secret worshippers at its shrine. for it was bebop itself, embodying, as it did, the spirit of rebellion par excellence within the world of jazz, that stood, yea, still stands, as the most pertinent role model for all later jazz revolutions. Modern Jazz Piano. As it is commonly told, the history of jazz piano mirrors the evolution of the music as a whole. Earl Hines is said to have developed a trumpet style in response to Armstrong's innovations. The pianism of Ellington is praised for representing a microcosm of his orchestral works. The music of Bud Powell, we are told, translated the advances of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie to the jazz keyboard. These generalizations, as clumsy as they are, and they are all too easy to criticize, still catch a broad truth. They rightly call our attention to the symbiotic relationship between the harmonic and rhythmic underpinnings of the music, epitomized in the work of jazz pianists, and the evolution of the monophonic improvised lines, best exemplified in the play of the horns. In this regard, jazz music is radically different from painting or literature or other mediums in which individuals work alone, in which the influence of others is felt at a distance as part of a cultural context. With few exceptions, the nature of jazz performance requires group interaction of the highest level. And much of the irony of jazz is that, for all its celebration of the individual soloist, it remains a music of ensembles. The story of each major innovator in the music's history, Armstrong, Ellington, Parker, Davis, Coleman, repeats this truism. There are no lonely geniuses in the jazz pantheon, for in this medium there is almost always the company of a band. By the mid-1940s, a distinctively modern jazz piano style had developed. Its historical antecedents were surprising. A decade before, most knowledgeable listeners would have looked toward Art Tatum, or perhaps to Duke Ellington, for an indication of the future of jazz piano. Their music seemed to encompass the most forward-looking thinking in terms of harmony, rhythm, melody. As it turned out, the orchestral approach to the keyboard of a Tatum or Ellington was too thick, too textured to work in the context of a bebop rhythm section. Instead, the new generation of modern jazz pianists looked for a leaner, more streamlined approach. This new style, as it developed, came to emphasize the right hand, which played fast melody lines laced with all the chromatic color tones and rhythmic flurries found in a Parker alto solo. The left hand supported this linear approach with supple comping chords, often simple structures built with only two or three notes, that were almost as important for their rhythmic kick as for their meager harmonic implications. In this regard, the bebop pianists were closer in spirit to Count Basie, the unassuming anti-virtuoso of Kansas City jazz, than to the more technically proficient stride and swing-era players. True, the influence of the stride tradition could not be completely shaken off. In particular, Tatum's triumphant mastery of the keyboard continued to haunt later players. Its influence lurked below the surface of even such committed modernists as Powell and Tristano, and was especially evident when these bebop piano titans played unaccompanied. Hints of the linear lines of Hines and Wilson could also be detected among the boppers, with Monk's modernism looking back even further to the work of James P. Johnson. Yet for the most part, the bebop players tended to be ruthless in jettisoning the excess baggage of the recent past in their attempts to find a purer, unencumbered voice for the jazz keyboard. No player realized this ideal better than Earl Bud Powell. Other modern jazz pianists might have boasted a more dexterous keyboard technique, Peterson, Newborn, or a cleaner touch, Marmorosa, Tristano, Cole, or more daring harmonies, Monk, Brubeck, or a more ebullient stage demeanor, Shearing, Garner, but none came closer to representing the spirit of the bebop movement than Powell, and none would be more influential during the post-World War II years. Powell's reconfiguration of the jazz piano vocabulary would have a deep and lasting impact on later players on the instrument. As such, he is one of those seminal artists whose influence is so pervasive that it is easy to overlook. When one person steals your stuff, it is robbery. When everybody does it over and over again, your belongings sooner or later become common property. But even when others imitated the mannerisms of Powell's style, as so many pianists learned to do, they rarely captured the preternatural vibrancy of the original. In the context of a modern jazz culture that celebrated personal commitment to intense and immediate emotional experiences, Powell appeared to have some special relation to the zeitgeist. The irony was that, for Powell, this attitude was no celebration. Perspiration dripping from his brow, his hands slashing at the keyboard, Bud Powell in public performance seemed to be fighting his private demons. And these demons eventually came to dominate him, abbreviating his career, which reached its peak long before Powell's death in 1966 at age 41. His most important works were recorded within a decade-long span from the mid-1940s to the mid-1950s. And even these works of a young man in his prime seemed to show a musical mind precariously close to teetering off the edge, as their very titles indicate: Oblivion, Un Poco Loco, Frantic Fancies, Glass Enclosure, Wail, Dance of the Infidels, So Sorry Please, Hallucinations. A casual observer could gather much about Powell simply by glancing at the names of his compositions. Powell, who was born in New York City on September 27, 1924, was raised in a musical family. His father William played stride piano. His older brother William Jr. learned the trumpet. His younger brother Richie also became a well-known jazz pianist. Bud's early training on the piano emphasized the European classical tradition, but even before his 10th birthday, Powell was drawn to the jazz styles of Fats Waller and Art Tatum. By age 15, he had left school to work as a professional musician. Before long, the after-hours clubs of Harlem beckoned. Here, Powell encountered the nascent sounds of bebop and met a friend and mentor in Thelonious Monk. 7 years older than Powell, Monk was serving as house pianist at Minton's Playhouse. When veteran players tried to dismiss Powell from the bandstand, Monk came to his defense. Some years later, Powell returned the favor, serving as an undaunted advocate of Monk's music at a time when few others took notice. When Powell embarked on his first major gig with Cootie Williams's band, he was persuasive in convincing Williams to record Monk's composition, Round Midnight, the debut recording of this now well-known jazz standard. It is fascinating to speculate about the nature of the friendship between these two masters of modern jazz keyboard. Each ranks among the most reclusive and enigmatic figures in the history of the music. Both were men of few words, and often even those few words were all but impossible to decipher. Jazz historians would give much to be a fly on the wall at one of their conversations, if indeed they were conversations in the normal sense of the word. In time, both pianists came to be viewed as mentally unbalanced. Powell spent much of his peak period of creativity in institutions of one sort or another, and Monk's reticence eventually reached a pathological extreme, although these tendencies may have seemed mere eccentricities at the time of their meeting. Powell and Monk no doubt shared similarities in background and interests, but even in the area of most common interest, jazz piano, their styles offered more differences than affinities. Monk's vertical keyboard style was almost a polar opposite of the horizontal approach favored by Powell. Yet the two retained a strong mutual admiration and willingness to assist each other, rare among jazz contemporaries who played the same instrument. In 1944, Powell recorded with Williams, both in big band and combo settings. Here, his modern jazz leanings, while already apparent, were tempered by swing-era conventions. During his stint with Williams, Powell was arrested for disorderly conduct while on a road trip to Philadelphia. In custody, Powell was severely beaten, and even when he was released, his health remained precarious. His mother needed to rent a car to bring him home to Harlem. Some have seen this event as triggering the pianist's chronic psychological instability. Certainly the timing was inauspicious. 10 days after the Philadelphia incident, Powell was placed in a sanatorium for the first time. Other periods of institutionalization followed. In these settings, his medical care ran the gamut from humane to savage, with his various treatments, including electroshock therapy and beatings. The miracle is that Powell managed so well for so long in the face of this dual existence as part-time patient, full-time jazz legend. His recordings from the late 1940s, made after his ordeal with electroshock therapy at Creedmoor, include some of the most compelling piano trio music in the history of jazz. His work on Fast Numbers is especially noteworthy. A session with Max Roach and Ray Brown from February 1949 produced three high-speed masterpieces, On Tempus Fugit, Powell exudes an almost diabolical level of energy, while on Two Standards, Cherokee, and All God's Chilingot Rhythm, Powell anchors his attack with intricate passing chords, working in contrary motion to the melody. The effect is surprising and strikingly original. A session from the following year finds Roach replaced by Buddy Rich. Here, Powell floors the gas pedal, apparently trying to take the tempo to its limits. It sounds as though the pianist is engaged in a race with a virtuoso drummer on a thrilling version of T for Two. These tracks possessed an odd, almost paradoxical quality, conveying a sense of mastery, yet also sounding as though they are on the brink of spinning out of control. Much of their appeal comes from this daredevil willingness to push to extremes in performance, a calling card of Powell's finest work. Powell was equally impressive when playing his own compositions. It is hard to understand why so few of his pieces have been recorded by other musicians. They boast memorable melodies, satisfying harmonic movement, and are generally good vehicles for improvisation. His medium-tempo pieces are especially strong. The Fruit, Celia, Bouncing with Bud, So Sorry Please, Cleopatra's Dream, Strictly Confidential, Hallucinations, and deserve to be as well known as the more frequently played compositions of Parker, Gillespie, Dameron, and Monk. Perhaps Powell himself was partly to blame. Unlike Monk or Gillespie, who frequently recorded the same compositions over and over and played them often in performance, Powell often left behind only a single studio recording of his finest pieces. Powell's greatest limitation was as a performer of ballads, but this was also a general weakness of his whole generation of jazz pianists. Not until the late 1950s did modern jazz piano refine an original and authentic approach to ballad playing. Powell had a glimpse of this future, as his impressionistic piece, Parisian Thoroughfare, makes clear. But for the most part, he remained under the shadow of Art Tatum when tackling slower tempos. The pieces are weighed down by ornamentation and cocktail piano virtuosity. Even a heartfelt composition such as Powell's I'll Keep Loving You finally collapses under the burden of these extraneous devices. Jazz piano would eventually break through this stylistic dead end by paring away ruthlessly at the unnecessary notes and ad-lib fills, a process propelled by the contributions of Bill Evans and Ahmad Jamal. But this radical pruning, built on a reassessment of the importance of space and silence, was still some years away at the time of Powell's best work. Along with most other pianists who came of age between 1940 and 1950, Powell was at his sharpest when the tempo approached or exceeded 200 beats per minute. Almost all of Powell's most important recordings were completed by the time of his 30th birthday. His late 1940s and early 1950 sessions for Norman Granz, now reissued on Verve, and Alfred Lion and Francis Wolff's Blue Note label stand out as paragon achievements, defining statement of bebop piano. In fact, Powell's reputation as the leading keyboard voice of the bebop movement would be well established if only on the basis of his extraordinary output from the two-year period stretching from May 1949 to May 1951. These 26 months encompassed a lifetime of music, strident trio sessions with Max Roach in May 1949, February 1950, and May 1951. The superb August 1949 combo recordings under the name Bud Powell's Modernists for Blue Note, which prefigure the coming hard bop movement. Two memorable quartet dates with Sonny Stitt from December 1949 and January 1950. A brief but notable July 1950 trio session with Buddy Rich, and an outstanding solo piano outing from February 1951. The quality of Powell's later work has been the subject of much debate, but even its most ardent supporters stop short of comparing it to these early efforts. Clearly, the later Powell was capable of occasional stellar performances. The best of these were often in the company of other premier jazz players, with Parker and Gillespie at Massey Hall in 1953, with Coleman Hawkins in 1960, with Dexter Gordon in 1963, or on occasional trio settings where he showed glimpses of greatness, as in his Lausanne recording from 1962. But these were, at best, compelling enough to remind listeners of Powell's early prowess, and never so good as to make them forget it. At its worst, Powell's playing in his later days could be execrable. His touch unsure, the tempo wobbly, his improvisations rarely broaching new ground. Powell on such evenings could sound like an automaton, futilely going through the motions of a jazz performance, without ever feeling it. His early work had been distinguished by a suppleness and gripping tension. His later work often seemed clouded by malaise. There were, of course, all too many reasons for this distressing decline. Powell's unstable mental health was increasingly matched by a deteriorating physical condition. Even small doses of alcohol could have a devastating effect, and friends learned to keep him away from the bottle at all costs. The death of his brother Richie in a 1956 auto accident, as well as the passing of Parker and many other of his contemporaries, may also have weighed heavily on Powell. In his early 30s, a period that finds most jazz players in peak playing form, Powell struggled with health problems and hospital stays. Nobody gave him much longer to live. His companion, Altivia Edwards, better known as Buttercup, later told an interviewer, "Not even me." But Powell survived and decided on an ambitious move across the Atlantic. In the spring of 1959, Powell arrived in Paris with Buttercup and her son John. This temporary visit stretched out to 5 years. The recordings from this period show that Powell was still capable at times of playing coherent and moving improvisations. But even Powell's better performances lacked the fire and ice of his earlier keyboard excursions. Despite this inconsistency, work was plentiful and audiences treated the pianist with respect bordering on adulation. In this new setting, Powell was blessed with a supportive phalanx of friends, fans, and acquaintances who conspired, with mixed results, to shepherd his health and keep him away from alcohol. Francis Padras, a commercial artist and jazz aficionado, eventually stepped forward as an unofficial guardian, overseer, and financial advisor, as well as vigilant defender of Powell against his critics. "People think Bud is crazy or lost or silent," he told one interviewer, "but he really is in a state of grace." This unusual and troubled relationship provided much of the inspiration for the 1986 film, Round Midnight. When Powell returned to the United States for a visit in August 1964, Padras accompanied him. In New York, however, the pianist could not be controlled as easily as in France, and on at least two occasions he disappeared for days at a time. When Padras decided to return to France, Powell stayed behind. Even the artist's most devoted fans could take little solace in his pianism during this final stage of his career. An engagement at Birdland received mixed reviews, but Powell's heavy-handed performance at a Charlie Parker Memorial concert left few doubts about his diminished capacities at the keyboard. He performed little after this, and his health continued to deteriorate. On July 31, 1966, less than 2 years after his New York homecoming, Powell died, ostensibly due to the combined effects of tuberculosis, alcoholism, and malnutrition. He was 41 years old. During the late 1940s and early 1950s, almost every major or minor keyboardist working in the modern jazz idiom showed, to a greater or lesser extent, the marks of Powell's influence. Lenny Tristano, John Lewis, George Wallington, Dodo Marmarosa, Al Haig, Walter Bishop, Kenny Drew, Joe Albany, and Hampton Hawes, to name just a few. In Detroit, Powell's linear style served as a springboard for a whole school of pianism. The so-called Detroit style actually spanned a wide range of sounds, stretching from the refined keyboard mannerisms of Hank Jones and Tommy Flanagan to the harder-driving piano work of Barry Harris. But all of them could trace their lineage back to Powell. By the mid-1950s, other jazz keyboard approaches had emerged, but even the pianists whose work stood out as the most original, Bill Evans, Horace Silver, Ahmad Jamal, Oscar Peterson, Cecil Taylor, still owed an enormous debt to this pioneer of modern jazz. The career of Powell's mentor and friend Thelonious Monk presents virtually a mirror image of this tale of dissipating creativity and declining fame. When Powell was at the peak of his powers, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, Monk was an all but forgotten figure in the jazz world. Around the same time that Powell's most fertile period ended in May 1951, Monk embarked on his own renaissance. In July of that year, Monk returned to the studios to record for Blue Note after a 3-year hiatus. This session kicked off a 15-year period in which Monk recorded prolifically, setting down classic tracks for Blue Note, Prestige, Riverside, and Columbia. By the 1960s, the reversal of roles was all but complete. At the point when Powell's career was in its final tailspin, Monk was recording for the most powerful label in the music industry, lauded by jazz fans, and even the subject of a 1964 cover story in Time magazine. This was an amazing turn of events for a figure who had been largely dismissed by critics and fans after his early involvement with the birth of modern jazz at Minton's. In 1942, Monk worked for Lucky Millinder. In 1944, he joined Coleman Hawkins. And in 1946, he spent some time with Gillespie's big band. These were solid sideman gigs, but stood out as rare interludes of employment during a difficult time in which chances for Monk to perform and record his music were infrequent at best. For the most part, the 1940s were a lost decade for Monk. In his 1949 book, Inside Bebop, one of the first critical efforts to come to grips with the new music, author Leonard Feather dismissed Monk out of hand. Monk's reputation, Feather asserted, was grossly distorted as a result of some high-powered publicity work. He has written a few attractive tunes, but his lack of technique and continuity prevented him from accomplishing much as a pianist. It is easy to blame the otherwise astute Feather for his obtuseness with regard to Monk, but Feather was not alone. At the close of the 1940s, Monk's music was perceived by most members of the jazz community as too far outside the mainstream to be valued in its own right, and too personal to influence other players. His style, built on disjunction, stood as a puzzling connect-the-dots drawing for which most listeners could not see the overall picture. For a time they called Monk the High Priest of Bop, and the nickname revealed how little the jazz world understood him. Despite the Minton's connection, Monk's mature music bore little resemblance to bebop. In contrast to the speed-obsessed work of Parker, Powell, and Gillespie, Monk preferred slow and medium tempos, and his process of improvising had a deliberate, hesitating quality. And though he occasionally tackled the standard songs of the bebop repertoire, Monk preferred to play his own pieces, and played them again and again, often recording the same tune a half dozen or more times over the course of his career. Even before Monk's comeback in the 1950s, the pianist gave notice of his singular vision of jazz, although few outside the inner circles of modern jazz were paying attention at the time. The amateur recordings made by Columbia student Jerry Newman at Minton's testify to the pianist's iconoclasm. One would be hard-pressed to find a more forward-looking jazz piano performance, circa 1941, than Monk's reconfiguration of George Gershwin's Nice Work If You Can Get It. In his 1944 sides with Coleman Hawkins, Monk revealed his zeal for experimentation to a wider audience, although he balanced his dissonances here with a judicious dose of more circumspect sounds. Here, for example, his solo on Flyin' Hawk, where the first 16 bars hew close to bebop, but the closing 16 bars sound the way jazz might be played in another galaxy. Yet the core of Monk's output from this decade came from the four sessions the pianist made for the Blue Note label during 1947 and 1948. Here, in these landmark recordings, Monk revealed his mature style as almost fully formed. In his debut session as a leader for Blue Note, Monk is weighed down by an unsympathetic horn section, and his piano solos are too brief. Yet even in this constrained setting, he showcases many of his characteristic devices, angular phrases and whole tone scales, the stark repetition of the simplest melodic fragments, serving almost as a parody of traditional thematic development, thick comping chords laced with dissonances and dropped with the subtlety of a hand grenade. Monk's second session, held 9 days later, dispenses with the horn players. In this piano trio setting, he adopts an even wider range of mannerisms, and not just his futuristic techniques, but snippets of older jazz styles as well. On the alternate take of Nice Work If You Can Get It, a remnant from Monk's Minton's days still in his repertoire, he slips in several unexpected bars of stride piano. On Ruby My Dear, he provides two bars of a figured bass that hint at the left-hand patterns of Boogie Woogie. Perhaps Mead Lux Lewis and Albert Ammons were on his mind. After all, they were favorites with Blue Note head Alfred Lion because on Well You Needn't, Monk again adopts elements of Boogie Woogie, this time in his right-hand block chords. But all these ingredients, whether old or new, borrowed or blue, manage somehow to cohere. The pianist's personal signature is so strong that everything he touches turns, if not to gold, at least to Monk. This date featured three of Monk's most famous compositions, Ruby My Dear, Well You Needn't, Off Minor. but even the popular standards included end up sounding like his originals. The two remaining Blue Note sessions from this period resulted in milestone performances of a number of other important Monk compositions, including Round Midnight, Epistrophe, I Mean You, Mysterioso, In Walked Bud, and Monk's Mood. In particular, the July 2, 1948 session, in which Monk plays Cat and Mouse with vibraphonist Milt Jackson, stood out as the most complete statement to date of his unorthodox musical values. Yet 3 years would elapse before Monk returned to the studio as a leader. In a prescient 1948 interview, Orrin Keepnews, who would later become Monk's record producer, cited the pianist as potentially representing a huge step forward in modern jazz, and noted that his music was further away from the bop idiom than most commentators had realized. But even Keepnews conceded that Monk was a little-known figure, and that only time and continued playing would determine his true merit. Most other journalistic accounts from the time preferred to emphasize the bizarre aspect of Monk's demeanor. An oft-repeated anecdote depicted him spending long periods staring at a photo of Billie Holiday taped to his ceiling, while the freshness of his music was usually restricted to a passing mention, a side note to his unconventional lifestyle. And those fans who hoped to make up their own mind about the so-called High Priest of Bop had little chance to do so. Monk played infrequent engagements, with most of his music-making taking place at home. Monk's return to the studio in July 1951 represented progress of sorts, but opportunities to record came at the same time that Monk's cabaret card was revoked due to a narcotics arrest. That event led to a 6-year involuntary absence from New York nightclubs. Meanwhile, Monk's recordings during this period document a major burst of creativity and set the foundation for his ascendancy to the top of the jazz world in the late 1950s and early 1960s. In his comeback session for Blue Note, Monk featured some of his most complex compositions. Günther Schuller has praised Crisscross, recorded at this date, for being much more than a tune or a song, but succeeding as a true composition for instruments, and likened it to the abstract painting in vogue around that time. In fact, all the pieces recorded by Monk at this session reflect the same virtues. The harmonies of Straight No Chaser are built on a standard 12-bar blues, but the melody is a clever exercise in the rhythmic displacement of a changeable motif, which sometimes ends on a blues note and sometimes resolves into a major third. Even more daring is 4-in-1, where Monk employs surprisingly fast, almost glissando-like passages in the melody line, like a painter unexpectedly smearing the canvas with sweeping brushstrokes. In some respects, these pieces represented a departure from the norm, to the extent that one could discuss a norm with regard to this non-conforming keyboardist, for Monk. Throughout his career, Monk had tempered his avant-garde tendencies with simple, repetitive, and almost childlike melodies. Pieces such as Epistrophe, Mysterioso, Blue Monk, Well You Needn't, Let's Cool One, Rhythmining, Hornin' In, Tinkle Tinkle, Bemsha Swing, and Off Minor boasted memorable, rigorously developed themes. These sing-song melodies stayed in listeners' ears long after the performance was over, and no doubt served for many as an inviting entry point into musical structures that, viewed from other angles, could be foreboding. Much of Monk's genius lay precisely in this ability to juxtapose the simple and complex, a talent he applied in many other ways, in his dramatic balancing of silence and oral density, his alternating use of thick and thin chords, his manner of incorporating wry humor into the often self-serious atmosphere of modern jazz. But at times, Monk would push the limits even further, building elaborate musical mazes such as 4-in-1 or Brilliant Corners, where not only the casual listener, but even skilled jazz players risked getting lost in the labyrinth. At the 1957 session that produced Brilliant Corners, a maddeningly difficult Monk chart that took 25 takes to complete, producer Keepnews interpreted the wry half-smiles of the sidemen, who included Sonny Rollins, Max Roach, and Oscar Pettiford, as signifying a silent lament. Hard? This is impossible. At the other end of the spectrum were Monk's ballads. Here his links to the American song tradition were most evident. One could envision compositions such as Round Midnight and Ruby My Dear performed by mainstream popular artists, perhaps even appealing to a non-jazz audience, hardly possible for Monk musical cons such as Epistrophe or Well You Needn't. Of course, even these ballads, when played by the composer, could take on all the quirky qualities of Monk's more experimental work, just as he could take pop standards such as Smoke Gets in Your Eyes or The Man I Love and make them sound like his own creations. But Monk was also capable of more harmonically ambiguous slow numbers, as in his evocative Crepuscule with Nelly, where his work captures a rarefied sensibility closer to the ambience of art song than either to jazz or popular music. The Blue Note relationship was followed by recordings for the Prestige label. These, for all their musical merits, achieved limited sales and only a tepid response from critics. Prestige eventually released Monk from his contract for the meager sum of $108.27. The pianist now signed with Riverside, a small record company run by Keep News, who by now had switched hats from journalist to producer, a role at which he would excel. This initiated a 6-year relationship during which Monk, under Keep News' supervision, undertook 28 recording sessions. These were fertile years for Monk, not so much because his music evolved during this period, on the contrary, his style changed very little after the mid-1940s, but because he was finally provided with a chance to express his musical ideas in a wide range of conducive contexts. Monk had always excelled in a trio setting, and his first several Riverside sessions followed that format. But soon Keep News was planning more elaborate dates, featuring larger bands and guest soloists. He was especially intent on creating opportunities for Monk to record alongside named saxophonists. The resulting projects showcased an impressive roster of horn players, including Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, Coleman Hawkins, Jerry Mulligan, Johnny Griffin, Phil Woods, Harold Land, and Charlie Rouse. The Riverside recordings also found Monk in the company of many of the leading drummers of modern jazz, including Max Roach, Kenny Clarke, Art Blakey, Roy Haynes, Shelly Mann, Art Taylor, and Shadow Wilson. These were ambitious and almost universally successful projects, and were especially impressive given that they were undertaken by a small independent jazz label that operated under severe financial constraints and would go bankrupt in 1964. By comparison, Monk's later recordings for CBS Columbia, the leading company in the industry with the deepest of pockets, rarely ventured beyond combo recordings with his working band. But the Riverside recordings were equally notable for their intimate sessions featuring Monk as a solo pianist. This was an ideal setting for him. His playing had always been distinguished by its open, uncluttered landscapes. "It's not the notes you play, it's those you leave out," he had once cryptically explained, but never more so than when working unaccompanied. Here he could expand time and tempo to their limits, as in his solo performance of I Should Care, where Monk takes a simple statement of the melody and lingers lovingly over these 32 bars for a full 3 minutes. Such performances also captured the full resonance and rich overtones of his harmonies, the distinctive crispness of his piano touch, and the orchestral implications of his keyboard style. Moreover, they represented a type of anti-virtuosity, a refreshing antidote to the elaborate patterns and runs, the florid cocktail piano mannerisms that had permeated the music since the days of Hines and Tatum. Despite his lengthy absence from the New York nightclub circuit, Monk's reputation was soaring and his records selling in increasing quantities. Infrequent public appearances may have only added to his mystique. A program for a 1955 concert described him tellingly as the Greta Garbo of jazz. The reinstatement of his cabaret card put an end to his apparent reclusiveness, but did nothing to hinder his popularity. His booking at the Five Spot during the summer of 1957 showed the breadth and depth of his newfound audience. Drawing full houses night after night, his engagement was extended to 8 months, and management brought in a special piano chosen by Monk himself. Even by Monk's standards, this was an exceptional band. "Those of us who heard it will never forget the experience," jazz historian Ira Gittler later recalled. "There were some weeks when I was at the Five Spot 2 or 3 times, staying most of the night even, when I intended just to catch a set or two." The attraction of this combo was as much its star saxophonist as it was Monk himself. John Coltrane was on the verge of establishing himself as the leading tenor saxophonist in jazz at the time he joined Monk's band. Coltrane had recently completed a high-profile stint with Miles Davis, following previous sideman gigs with Dizzy Gillespie and Johnny Hodges, and had just recorded his first album as a leader for the Prestige label. Even at this early point in his career, Coltrane stood out from the pack with his explosive improvisations, his technical prowess, and the unprecedented energy of his performances. The following year, Downbeat would christen him an angry young tenor, a misnomer given Coltrane's reflective nature and spiritual leanings, but an appropriate response to his intemperate saxophone playing. More to the point was Gittler's oft-quoted description of Coltrane's style as a relentless spinning forth of sheets of sound. In this regard, Coltrane took the implications of Byrd one step further. The notes are even more densely packed, the traditional jazz syncopations and rhythmic inflections even less prominent. Instead, Coltrane favored cascading waterfalls of notes, scales, arpeggios, figures, sometimes played in short bursts, at other times expanded in breathlessly elongated phrases. Coltrane's tenure with Monk lasted only a few months, and has often been cited as a period of apprenticeship, an important contributor to the tenor player's development as a jazz musician. Coltrane himself frequently expressed his admiration for Monk, praising him as a musical architect of the highest order. But the recordings made by Monk's band during this period show that the tenorist was anything but overawed by his new employer. Indeed, one is hard-pressed to find another Monk sideman who did so little to adapt to the idiosyncrasies of the pianist's music. On recordings such as Trinkle Tinkle or Nutty, Coltrane unleashes powerful solos that, rather than emulating Monk's use of space or compositional style of improvisation, as so many others did when playing with a pianist, reflect the saxophonist's own emphatic, virtuosic style. Compare these, for instance, with Sonny Rollins's collaborations with Monk, successful in their own way, which find the horn player constructing incisive thematic solos, challenging the music from inside, rather than imposing his personality on top of it. In a surprising turnaround, Monk came to adapt to Coltrane, even going so far as not playing behind some of the sax solos, allowing the tenorist to stretch out with just bass and drum backing, much as the saxophonist would do a few years later with his own band. In the final analysis, this was an extraordinary ensemble, one of the most creative units of its day, not because Coltrane served as a disciple to Monk, as is so often stated, but because these two masters of the jazz idiom met, for the most part, on equal terms. During their few months together, these two premier stylists, one espousing a music of pregnant pauses and lingering overtones, the other filling each measure to the fullest to overflowing in a music of delirious excess, called to mind the physicist's assertion that the creative energy of the universe is founded ultimately on the attraction of opposites. On the crest of the sensation caused by the five-spot band, Monk was enjoying unprecedented attention and praise, first among jazz insiders, who awarded him first place in the Downbeat Critics Poll in both 1958 and 1959, and gradually from the general public. He now toured frequently, both throughout the United States and overseas, and by 1960 was able to demand $1,000 for a one-night stand, substantially more than what he had charged for a full week booking only 2 years earlier. For his 1959 town hall concert, the pianist was given an ample budget to finance a performance of his music with a large band and cover the cost of suitably Monk-esque arrangements provided by Hall Overton. The concert was taped and released on Keep News' Riverside label, which was now recording Monk more frequently than ever, and with constantly improving sales. But these were also troubling years for the pianist. His odd mannerisms and on-stage demeanor may have amused audiences, but the deeper-seated psychological problems they represented were no laughing matter. In 1958, Monk's obsessive pacing in a Delaware hotel lobby and his steadfast refusal to respond to questions led to a heated confrontation with local police. The following year, Monk ended a strange performance at Boston's Storyville Club by remaining seated on the piano bench, motionless and impassive, long after his sidemen had left the stage. Later that same night, Monk was arrested at the airport and brought by a state trooper to Grafton State Hospital, where he was placed under observation for a week. During the 1960s, Monk received medical treatment for depression, and his personality grew ever more remote. Sometimes he would remain aloof for days at a time, with even his wife Nellie unable to attract more than a word or two from him. Monk's music seemed largely unaffected by these problems. Then again, a certain psychological distance from the mundane and everyday had always been an ingredient of his artistry. Moreover, eccentricity fueled publicity. Indeed, the pianist's fame and following were now great enough to attract the interest of a major label. In 1962, Monk signed with Columbia, and under the aegis of this entertainment industry powerhouse, his reputation continued to grow, even if his music changed little, culminating in a February 28, 1964 Time magazine cover story. By the mid-1960s, Monk was as much a legend as a musician, yet his recordings for Columbia, although solid efforts, broke little new ground. His repertoire drew heavily on material he had recorded in earlier years. The settings were rarely as imaginative as those Keep News had created for the Riverside recordings. Most of the Columbia releases featured Monk in the context of his working band, which now included saxophonist Charlie Rouse. Rouse was a skilled journeyman player, especially sensitive to the nuances of Monk's music, but he did little to make listeners forget the earlier pairings with Coltrane, Rollins, and other saxophone masters. Still, the best of these works served as important additions to Monk's oeuvre. Despite the travails of his personal life, Monk maintained a fairly hectic recording and performance schedule during his first several years with Columbia. But by the close of the 1960s, his activities had tapered off. In the 1970s, Monk's public appearances, like his Delphic utterances, grew even less frequent. As befitted a legend, he remained mostly out of sight. His last official performance came at a Carnegie Hall concert in 1976, but, in an appropriate coda to his career, Monk surprised listeners one night after that by sitting in at Bradley's, a small New York bar where few would have expected this reclusive jazz master to grace the keys. In his final years, the pianist resided with the Baroness de Königswarter, who had also befriended Charlie Parker during the altoist's last illness. On February 5, 1982, Monk suffered a stroke and died 12 days later at Englewood Hospital in New Jersey. He was 64 years old. As early as the mid-1950s, a few jazz pianists were paying close attention to Monk's example. For players such as Herbie Nichols, Richard Twardzik, Randy Weston, Mal Waldron, and Elmo Hope, several elements of Monk's playing proved especially influential. First and foremost, the vertical conception of his music offered a robust alternative to the essentially linear approach of most post-war pianists. Similarly, Monk's textured chords, sinewy melodies, and assertive rhythms served as open marks of rebellion against the cool school, then in the ascendancy, and its attempts to find a crossover audience for jazz among the general public. In essence, Monk figured as patron saint for those who saw jazz as an underground movement resisting assimilation. His music's prickly exterior was perhaps not intended to make it sound foreboding, but for his admirers, the sharp edges were a virtue, a fitting defense mechanism to repel all but an inner clique. But Monk's music was equally admired for its primal insistence, for his vision of the piano as a percussion instrument, a sensibility that shaped the pianist's tone control, phrasing, and sense of rhythm. In many ways, this was merely a return to the earliest jazz keyboard tradition, and as such, it should come as no surprise that Monk and Nichols had strong ties to the stride idiom. But it was also a link to the later avant-garde players, most notably Cecil Taylor, who would owe much to Monk's celebration of the piano as a giant tuned drum with manifold possibilities. Following Monk's model, however, was fraught with difficulties in the mid-1950s. Nichols, Twardzik, and Hope have each reached far more recognition posthumously than during their abbreviated careers. All were dead before their mid-40s, leaving behind only a handful of recordings to testify to their potent reworkings of the jazz tradition. Herbie Nichols, one of the most brilliant modern jazz composers and pianists of his day, made just 3 albums as a leader, with most of his working life spent playing in Dixieland bands. Nichols's attack and the basic elements of his musical vocabulary show a great debt to Monk, but his performances are more driving, more densely packed. And in the place of Monk's sly humor, they tend toward a brittle hardness, somber and remote, at times bordering on an academic otherworldliness. Nichols's best recordings, The Third World, 2300 Skidoo, Blue Chopsticks, Cro-Magnon Nights, are powerful statements, totally free from cliché, and revealing a poised balance between form and content. Twardzik spent even less time in the recording studio than Nichols, but the few items in his discography reveal a progressive thinker of titanic proportions. His music raises obvious comparisons with Monk's, but is also notable for its links to 20th century classical music and its anticipation of the later free jazz movement. Twardzik's reputation rests primarily on a single trio session and sideman efforts with Serge Chaloff and Chet Baker. However, these are substantial works by any measure, and indicate that had he lived longer, Torjic was dead of a drug overdose before his 25th birthday, he might have established himself as one of the leading jazz players of his generation. Hope's visionary style came to the fore on recordings made as both a leader and sideman in New York during the mid-1950s, but the revocation of his cabaret card due to drug problems limited his ability to build on these accomplishments. After relocating to California, Hope undertook sessions under his own name, as well as contributed greatly to the success of Harold Land's classic recording, The Fox. Like Monk, Hope found his music branded as difficult, and few listeners were willing to make the effort to probe its rich implications. He continued to work and record sporadically after his return to New York in early 1961, until his death 6 years later, but never gained a following commensurate with the virtues of his steely and multifaceted music. Lenny Tristano's impact on the development of jazz piano is perhaps even more difficult to gauge than Monk's. During most of his life, Tristano remained an outsider in the jazz world. He recorded little and, as the years passed, increasingly restricted his music-making to the confines of his home. His influence was more often exerted indirectly, through the activities of his students and followers, rather than his own efforts. At times, this core of ardent admirers took on the appearance of a cult, of which Tristano stood as high priest and oracle. For members, Tristano was the seer who saw the outlines of the future of jazz, celebrating it as a rugged, cerebral music, unforgiving and uncompromising. For those less favorably inclined, Tristano was a monomaniac whose mark on the jazz scene was a matter of manipulation, rather than a result of superior musical values. In such a charged atmosphere, it was difficult to find a middle ground in evaluating Tristano. One was either a devotee or a traitor to the cause, and few could live up to the demands Tristano placed on his devotees. Accordingly, with the passage of time, Tristano's inner circle found fewer and fewer new acolytes. In the last 20 years of his life, his performances were increasingly rare, new recordings all but non-existent, and older ones mostly out of print. By the time of his death in 1978, Tristano was a largely forgotten figure, relegated to the fringes of the jazz world. Yet there was some irony to this turn of events, for the evolution of jazz piano was increasingly turning in precisely the direction that Tristano had foretold. His phrasing across the bar lines, his superimposition of elaborate polyrhythms over the ground beat, his biting percussiveness, his splintered harmonic structures, these key elements to Tristano's playing from the 1940s and 1950s were now appearing as defining elements in jazz piano in the years following his death. In many instances, younger players were coming to these same endpoints not because they had listened to Tristano, emphatically in many instances they had not, although most had listened deeply to Bill Evans, who had carefully studied Tristano in his school, but because these developments were logical extensions of the modern jazz idiom. Moreover, a number of Tristano's most daring initiatives from the late 1940s and early 1950s, involving atonality, total improvisation, overdubbing, and other unusual devices, could now be seen as foreshadowing key developments in the later history of jazz. In this regard, Lenny Tristano was something of a Nostradamus of the bop era. When the future of jazz finally arrived, it bore a striking resemblance to his personal vision of how it should be. A flu epidemic left Tristano blind shortly after his birth in Chicago on March 19, 1919. He began piano studies under his mother's supervision and later pursued a more extensive musical education at a school for the blind. By the time he had completed high school, Tristano had learned to play saxophone, tenor, alto, and C melody, clarinet, trumpet, guitar, and drums. Even before his teens, he was working professionally, and only gradually came to focus his energies on the piano. After completing his bachelor's degree at the American Conservatory of Music, Tristano began taking students in addition to performing in and around the Chicago area. By 1945, Tristano had attracted a small coterie of promising pupils, including saxophonist Lee Konitz, guitarist Billy Bauer, and composer-trombonist Bill Russo. Tristano's first recordings, made around this time, revealed that his style was already fully formed, and that his conception of the keyboard was frighteningly advanced. Günther Schuller has cited Tristano's 1946 trio performance of I Can't Get Started as a landmark in the development of jazz, comparing it to Armstrong's West End Blues and Ellington's Cottontail. Again, it is the futuristic element of the music that is compelling. its startling harmonic conception, bordering at times on atonality, and its rhythmic complexity leading Schuller to praise the performance as one of the most prophetic recordings in all jazz history. But in many ways, Schuller concludes, the performance was too far ahead of its time. In truth, placing Tristano within the context of a specific period in jazz movement has proven all too difficult. Most commentators and historians have listed him as a member of the cool school that predominated during the 1950s, but this classification captures only a small part of